The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we are in our second reading from the December 31st, 2020, January 8th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine, their year-end issue called the Faces of 2020. We read some of the more newsy stuff last week, and we'll get into the year-end review material this week. And I'll start with a note to the readers and a comment afterwards. The note to the readers is, the Week staff is taking a two-week break for the holidays. Your next issue will arrive in 3 weeks. Our next edition will be dated January 22nd and should begin arriving on January 15th. The Week currently publishes 48 issues a year. What that means for you is this will be a new show, and this show will run again next week. And then we'll get into the first issue of 2021. This will be a long read, and I look forward to it every year. It's called The Year in Review. January. Election year dawns, but President Donald Trump is facing a more immediate eviction from the Oval Office. Impeached by the House for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, Trump now faces trial in the Senate, though his acquittal by the Republican majority is all but assured. In Wuhan, China, authorities shutter a meat and seafood market after 59 people fall ill with a mysterious viral infection. Within 2 weeks, the highly infectious virus has sickened 500, killing 17 in the entire city of Wuhan. Population 11 million is quarantined amid warnings the outbreak could turn into a pandemic. In Washington state, a 35-year-old man recently returned from China becomes the first person in the U.S. to be diagnosed with an illness caused by what the World Health Organization is now calling SARS-CoV-2, or the novel coronavirus. President Trump dismisses the threat of a wider outbreak. It's one person coming in from China, he tells reporters. It's going to be just fine. On January 31st, however, WHO declares a global health emergency, and Trump bans all foreign nationals from entering the U.S. from China. At least 27,000 U.S. citizens visiting or living in China, however, are allowed to return. February. Senate Republicans vote to acquit Trump, with the sole exception of Utah Senator Mitt Romney, who becomes the first senator in U.S. history to vote to remove a president of his own party from office. The coronavirus continues to rage through Asia and Central Europe, with Iran and the Lombardy region of Italy hit particularly hard. The U.S. still has only 15 confirmed cases of COVID-19, as the disease is now known, but Dr. Nancy Messonnier of the Centers for Disease Control warns that further spread is inevitable. Disruption to everyday life might be severe, she says. An angry Trump disagrees and predicts that the virus will shortly disappear like a miracle. Trump's upbeat comments reflect his growing concern that fears of a pandemic could hurt the economy and his reelection chances. Democrats begin their formal process of choosing a challenger, with former Vice President Joe Biden, 77, the frontrunner in a historically wide field of 29 candidates. despite the lack of enthusiasm he generates among party's young progressives. At the Iowa caucuses, Pete Buttigieg, 38, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, narrowly beats Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, who then narrowly beats Buttigieg in New Hampshire. In delegate-rich South Carolina, however, Biden scores a comeback win with the overwhelming support of African-American voters. March. Flush with momentum, Biden wins 10 of the 15 Super Tuesday primaries, prompting a mass exodus of candidates from the Democratic field. The race is now a two-man contest between Biden and Sanders, but politics are quickly overshadowed as COVID-19 hits the U.S. with a vengeance. The bulk of cases are in the Northeast, New York City in particular, where exhausted hospital staff work around the clock, triaging a flood of patients struggling to breathe, with the sickest going on ventilators. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issues a statewide stay-at-home order, and 41 other states soon follow suit. The economic impact is immediate. More than 10 million Americans file for unemployment in a single month amid historic stock market plunges, and the devastation shocks Congress into passing the CARES Act, a $2.2 trillion stimulus bill. Criticized for his denialism, Trump declares a national emergency and starts holding daily, rambling White House briefings on the crisis. The briefings turn Dr. Anthony Fauci, 79, the leading U.S. infectious disease expert, into an unlikely star. At one briefing, Trump dismisses a question about his role in the virus' catastrophic spread and the massive shortage of diagnostic tests and protective gear for medical workers. "No, I don't take responsibility at all," Trump says. Sanders suspends his campaign and quells fears of Democratic schism by telling Biden, a public Zoom call, that we've got to make Trump a one-term president. Zooming, along with social distancing, flattening the curve, and N95, become part of a new vocabulary and way of life for tens of millions of quarantined Americans. But with the election season looming, Trump is impatient to reopen the country and starts touting the unproven benefits of hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug, to treat COVID-19. At one instantly notorious briefing, Trump even floats the idea of treating the disease with very powerful light and household disinfectants by injection inside. May. The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 reaches 100,000, and Trump announces Operation Warp Speed, a public-private partnership with pharmaceutical companies to develop a coronavirus vaccine in record time. In Minneapolis, police arrest George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, on suspicion of passing a counterfeit bill. During the arrest, which is videoed by a bystander, Officer Derek Chauvin, 44, kneels on Floyd's neck for 7 minutes and 46 seconds, even as Floyd, already handcuffed, pleads, "I can't breathe." His killing sparks angry protest and fire setting on the streets of Minneapolis, which quickly spread to other cities. After multiple incidents of rioting and looting, Trump threatens a nationwide crackdown, warning on Twitter that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. June. Warming to law and order as a new campaign theme, Trump has the National Guard clear peaceful protesters by force from Lafayette Square, adjacent to the White House, so that he can march to a nearby church, where he silently holds aloft a Bible. But the anger unleashed by George Floyd's death is now a worldwide movement, with peaceful protest in more than 60 countries. As people head outside to enjoy warming weather, the rate of new infections begins to slow in parts of the country, while growing in others, as many states begin a cautious, phased reopening. July. 7 months into the pandemic, Trump grudgingly wears a face mask in public for the first time. But masks have already emerged as an unlikely front in the culture wars, with many conservatives following Trump's lead and rejecting them as a statist infringement on personal freedom. Herman Cain, 74, the former pizza magnate and GOP presidential candidate, dies of COVID-19 only weeks after attending, without face mask, a Trump indoor rally in Tulsa. Democrats push to expand mail-in voting so that people need not risk COVID to cast a ballot. But on Twitter, Trump begins a steady drumbeat of baseless claims that mail-in voting will lead to the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. August. Apocalyptic wildfires ravage California, a depressing new normal for the state every summer. And Joe Biden announces Senator Kamala Harris, 55, as his running mate. The selection of a woman of color and the possibility of ousting Trump energizes Democrats, who shower the ticket with donations as the parties hold two contrasting conventions. At the all-virtual DNC, keynote speakers praise Biden as a paragon of empathy, and former President Barack Obama blasts Trump for treating the presidency as just one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves. All four nights of the RNC feature addresses by Trump, speaking from the White House lawn, where he warns that Biden is a Trojan horse for socialism. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, police responding to a domestic incident shoot Jacob Blake, another black man, four times in the back. Blake survives but is paralyzed, and the shooting touches off a fresh round of sometimes violent protests. September. In Washington, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 87, dies of cancer. Within days, Trump nominates conservative appeals court judge Amy Coney Barrett, 48, to replace the liberal icon, and urges the Senate to confirm Barrett before November, openly stating that he expects her to rule on any election disputes in his favor. The New York Times obtains two decades of the president's long-hidden tax records. Trump, it seems, paid only $750 in income tax for two of the years examined and nothing at all in another 10, and owes $421 million to unknown creditors. In the first presidential debate, a red-faced Trump repeatedly interrupts and talks over Biden and moderator Chris Wallace for 90 hard-to-watch minutes. The president warns that the upcoming election may be rigged and tells the Proud Boys, a far-right extremist group, to stand by. 200,000 Americans and 1 million people worldwide have now died from COVID-19. October. After months of scorning masks, Trump himself tests positive for COVID-19, and when his blood oxygen level drops, spends 3 days in Walter Reed Medical Center receiving steroids and an experimental monoclonal antibody therapy. The treatment apparently works, and Trump stages a theatrical return to the White House, climbing the South Portico steps in a show of vitality, then ripping off his face mask and saluting. In another presidential debate in Nashville, moderator Kristen Welker, armed with a mute button, oversees a relatively substantive debate and a much more controlled performance by the president. But it has little impact on the poll, which shows Biden leading Trump by a comfortable average of 9 percentage points on the eve of the election. November. Election day arrives, and as votes are tallied, the predicted red mirage shows Trump leading several states when the polls close. But later that night and in ensuing days, Biden pulls ahead as big city and mail ballots are counted in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and even Georgia. In a record turnout, Biden amasses more than 81 million votes. But Trump runs closer than polls predicted, with 74 million. Republicans gain seats in the House and look set to retain the Senate if they can win one of two January runoff elections in Georgia. Despite the down-ballot success for the GOP, Trump dismisses the election as a fraud on the American public. At a bizarre conference held for unknown reasons at Four Seasons Total Landscaping in Philadelphia, a lawn care business next to an adult bookstore, Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani says he and the campaign will soon present a very, very strong case in the courts proving massive election fraud. Over three tragic comic weeks, dozens of judges, many of them Trump appointees, tartly note that no credible evidence of fraud has been provided and reject Trump's baseless claim to have won the election. Trump eventually authorizes the release of transition funds to the Biden campaign, but still insists on Twitter that our case strongly continues and I believe we will prevail. December. Trump does not prevail. The Supreme Court rules against him twice, dismissing an astonishing lawsuit brought by the Texas Attorney General asking the court to nullify the election results in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Electoral College formally certifies Joe Biden as the 46th President of the United States. Trump, however, defiantly maintains that the election was stolen, and polls show an ominous 77% of Republicans agreeing with him. Meanwhile, the pandemic rages on. COVID-19 has now killed more than 300,000 Americans, and the rate of new infections soars to more than 1 million a week across the nation. But in mid-December, as promised, the first doses of vaccine arrive and are administered to frontline healthcare workers. "I feel like healing is coming," said Sandra Lindsay, a New York City nurse who became the first American to be vaccinated. After the bleakest year in memory, the vaccines spark hope that 2021 will be a much better year. This is a Faces of 2020 feature called the End of Year Quiz. I'm not sure we've actually done it before, but there are some 31 questions. I will not do all of them. I'm going to pick a smattering from the pages, and I'll read the question and give a brief pause, and then I'll give you the answer. So first, since 2000, there have been a dozen campaigns for president on the Democratic and Republican lines. Of these, John McCain received the lowest share of the votes, with 45.7% in 2008. Where did Donald Trump's share of the vote in 2020 place him on this list, if one is the most and 12 is the least? The answer is number 10, with 46.9% of the vote. Which member of the coronavirus task force predicted in late April that by Memorial Day weekend, we will have this coronavirus epidemic behind us? That was Vice President Mike Pence. Moderna and Pfizer used a breakthrough genetic technology to design a molecule that prompts the body to make a copy of the spike proteins on the surface of the coronavirus and evoke a powerful immune response. What is the molecule called? The answer there is messenger RNA. What is President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s unusual middle name? I did not know this. The answer is Robinette. Which world leader has installed a disinfection tunnel at his palatial home to spray incoming visitors with sanitizer to protect against the coronavirus? I think we reported this one originally, and that is Russian President Vladimir Putin. This South Korean movie took home the most awards at this year's Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay, leading President Trump to gripe, "Can we get like Gone with the Wind back, please?" And that movie was Parasite. This French luxury goods tycoon briefly overtook Jeff Bezos and became the world's richest person in 2020. And that is Bernard Arnault. And finally, I'll give you a quote from the Wit and Wisdom page and see if you can decide who it came from. Fight for the things you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. That was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Our next year-in-review piece is the poll watch. The way we were in 2020. We worried about democracy and catching a deadly disease, but found comfort in video games and ice cream. How are we feeling? Pretty despondent. 71% think the U.S. is headed in the wrong direction, and 47% that our democratic system no longer works well. 61% believe we're on the verge of civil war, and 52% are stockpiling food in case of social unrest. Only 24% report feeling proud about America. 78% say the pandemic has been a major source of stress, causing 20% to suffer unexpected mood swings, and 17% to yell at loved ones. Whom do we blame for America's woes? Many pin our problems on the outgoing president. 64% say Donald Trump has exacerbated the country's divisions. 32% say he's made Washington more corrupt. But he has plenty of defenders. 22% believe Trump will go down in history as one of the greatest presidents. 36% think the election was stolen from him, and 37% want him to run again in 2024. How has society changed? We're increasingly aware of racism. 59% now say black people face discrimination, and 52% say so of Hispanics, about double the shares in 2008. 58% think racism is built into American institutions, 39% that police don't treat racial groups equally, and 58% want major police reform. But 59% oppose the defund the police movement. What do we do to relax? sit down in front of a screen. 75% are using streaming services more since the pandemic began, with 56% rewatching shows they've already seen rather than search out something new. 29% are binging video games, playing for an average of 3.3 hours a session. The pandemic and all that screen time is interfering with our snoozing. 51% pinpoint 2020 as their worst year for sleeping, with 34% blaming consuming too much news for their lack of shut-eye, and 13% late-night Netflix jags. We've acquired other bad habits amid the contagion. 41% are scarfing more comfort food, with 55% upping their pizza intake, and 46% their ice cream consumption. Perhaps unsurprisingly, 85% gained weight in recent months, adding an average of 6 pounds. What scares us? Getting sick. 68% fear that they or someone in their family will catch the coronavirus. 66% already know somebody who's had COVID-19. 23% have close friends or family members who died from the disease. A disturbingly large number think the pandemic is bunk. 38% suspect its death toll has been deliberately and greatly exaggerated. That's not the only baseless conspiracy theory Americans believe. 6% buy the QAnon theory that a satanic deep state is running a global child sex trafficking ring, and 28% that Microsoft founder Bill Gates is hiding location tracking microchips in COVID-19 vaccine shots. And that would be a nice segue to our next short piece. I don't always read these week to week, but here for the year end, why not? It must be true, the best of the tabloids in 2020. Residents of Lake Worth Beach, Florida, called 911 when they heard chilling screeches from a neighbor's house. "Let me out, let me out. Oh!" Four sheriff's deputies arrived to find a man calmly working on a car in the driveway, who said he'd introduce them to the screamer. "I promptly introduced the officers to Rambo," said the unnamed man of his 40-year-old parrot. "We all had a good laugh." An Australian man was arrested after he was hired to fulfill another man's sexual fantasy of being tied up and threatened, and then showed up at the wrong house. Terrence Leroy and a partner entered a home armed with machetes to act out their client's fantasy and found a man in bed. "Is your name Kevin?" they asked. The startled man said it was not, and Leroy shook his hand and said, "Sorry, mate." Leroy was later arrested, but was acquitted by a judge who said the evidence indicated his intimidating actions were the result of a mistake. "The facts of the case are unusual," the judge said. A forklift driver from Canada has remade his life by tattooing himself almost entirely in a Smurf-like blue. Donnie Snyder, 26, said his decision was rooted in a desire to quit hiding and break myself out of stagnation. Since then, he slowly transformed almost every inch of his body, including his face. Reactions have been mixed, including gasp, free beers, and hugs. "It's like living life in strange mode," he said. "It's definitely striking, and I think it's a beautiful color." A Chinese man was presented with a dinner bill for nearly $3,000 after a woman brought 23 of her relatives along to their first date. The man looked on uncomfortably as the woman's family began ordering pricey dishes and drinks. She said she was testing if he would be generous enough to pay for all 25 people. Instead, the man fled and did not reply to repeated attempts to contact him, leaving her to foot the bill. This is a piece called The Cultural Year in Review. And it starts with the title, Quiet Time, Lessons from an Unprecedented Shutdown. For many hard-hit art institutions, 2020 ended up on a hopeful note when Congress finally passed a $900 billion stimulus bill that included $15 billion in aid for theaters, movie houses, live music venues, and museums. 9 months into a crisis that had already forced hundreds of venues to close for good and caused a $33 billion decline in the live music industry alone, federal lawmakers finally responded to the rolling calamity by authorizing the largest government rescue of the arts in U.S. history. Here are a few of the things, cultural-wise, and I won't read all of them, but we'll go into them each a little bit. Movies, the end of a dull era. When America goes back to the movie theaters one day, what if the experience is better than we left it? Asked Jordan Crucioli in Wired. It could happen. Currently, American moviegoing is in absolute crisis, with even the big chain AMC near bankruptcy. Industry analysts tell Quartz.com that COVID may knock out 20% of all U.S. screens before the return to normal. But normal shouldn't be the dream of moviegoers, because normal kind of sucked. Before COVID, the economics of the business demanded franchise blockbusters fueled by huge marketing onslaughts that deprived smaller, more adventurous films of all oxygen. The rise of streaming, which was on track to produce more revenue than theatrical releases even before the pandemic, has proven that there are quality films that viewers will find and enjoy if media outlets make the space to spotlight them. Theater, a regional awakening. You don't have to wait until a COVID-19 vaccine is widely available to rediscover the incomparable pleasure of watching a really good show, said Terry Teachout in the Wall Street Journal. In this year that has been dark, that has darkened so many stages, one silver lining has been that excellent regional theaters throughout the country are learning to film their productions and stream them for viewers to watch at home. These companies have long mounted shows as good as anything you can see in New York, and now you don't even have to take my word for it. With live theater unlikely to return for months, it's time for theater lovers to discover such offerings as Flawless, recent production of Will Arbery's Heroes of the Fourth Turning, a 2020 Pulitzer Prize finalist, created by Philadelphia's Wilma Theater. Live music, a virtual solution. On the late November weekend, when Dua Lipa performed a live show and attracted 5 million viewers, the music industry changed forever, said Ethan Millman in Rolling Stone. Live-streamed concerts had been a lifeline for musical artists all year. With concert venues closed, performers pumped out more than 60,000 live streams in 2020, their backdrops ranging from a living room to the Grand Canyon. And the share requiring a viewer fee jumped from 2% in June to more than half by November. But Team Lipa raised the bar when it spent $1.5 million to stage a choreographed dance party that showcased the pop diva's hit recent tracks, as well as special guests Elton John, Bad Bunny, and Miley Cyrus. Roughly 300,000 tickets were sold at $10 each, while streaming services in some overseas markets paid to let subscribers watch for free. Museums striving to matter again. As even its flag bearers are now ready to admit, said Andres Zanto in the Art newspaper, the art museum needs a rethink. A terrible past year has taught museum officials around the world that politicians and the public do not share the insiders' belief that their institutions are indispensable. Why else would museums have been forced to stay closed far longer than hardware stores and to survive so long with little government aid? Nearly 30% of all museum employees in the U.S. have been laid off or furloughed since March, But the shocks of 2020, including the George Floyd protest, have accelerated a widespread and growing drive among institutional leaders to redefine and reposition the museum. Monuments, what's next? In light of the pandemic and this summer's protest against racial oppression, the question of what to put in a newly vacant town plaza might seem a small one, said Hua Su in NewYorker.com. But Richmond, Virginia, and dozens of other American communities are reckoning with how to replace Confederate monuments that were removed or toppled in the wake of George Floyd's killing and the demonstrations that followed. The Southern Poverty Law Center reported that 60 such monuments were taken down this summer, leaving almost 700 standing. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has asked state lawmakers to allocate $11 million to a museum-led effort to reimagine the city's Monument Avenue and the towering equestrian statue of Robert E. Lee that occupies its most prominent intersection. Work in progress, the Genius Watch. Work in progress, the Genius Watch. In perilous, isolating times, we hunger with a special zeal for great work by artists who can capture the experience for us, said Peter Marks in the Washington Post. William Shakespeare is thought to have written King Lear while in quarantine as the bubonic plague ravaged London in 1606. AIDS devastated the performing arts in the 1980s, but also fueled the creation of at least two massively influential dramas, Tony Kushner's Angels in America and Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart. Still, as Albert Camus dramatized in The Plague, a 1946 novel inspired by a cholera epidemic, isolation and fear can just as easily stifle creativity. During our crisis year, we have had evidence that either dynamic could be in play. Original online theater productions have delivered small spoonfuls of the type of powerful and timely art we can hope come later. The Line, a docuplay launched by New York City's Public Theater, put the words of real-life healthcare workers in the mouths of actors. In Washington, D.C.'s Theater Alliance this month wrapped up a festival of many plays about black protest. But will these welcome morsels be followed by books, dramas, movies, or even operas that are more ambitious, duly enraged, and fully realized? For now, we have to sustain ourselves with the belief that the great work has just begun. What we have now is a, it's kind of an art section. They call it the Critics' Choice. It's a review of, we have the best books of the year, fiction, nonfiction, best music, best film, and best TV. And it would take us much more time than we've got here to go into all of it. So what I'm going to do is read you the critics' top choice in each category. And then I'll just go down the list, giving the title and authors for the other ones on the list. So starting with the review of books, this are the year's best novels. Number one is called Homeland Elegies by Ayad Akhtar. Every so often, we are gifted a novel that combines deep intelligence, meticulous prose, and something profound to say about the state of our world, said Lucas Whitman in Time. In Ayad Akhtar's masterful work of autobiographical fiction, a protagonist who shares the author's name and career as a celebrated American playwright confronts the dilemma of trying to live in a post-9/11 America that questions his right to call it his home, even though he has never known another. The parents of the novel's Akhtar are Pakistani immigrants, including a physician father who once treated Donald Trump for a heart problem. As the family struggles to define itself, The complexities of the American dream have never been so naked. A great Gatsby figure eventually arrives who makes Octa rich, and said Dwight Garner in the New York Times. He also becomes Octa's sparring partner in debates about predatory capitalism and Muslim values as Homeland Elegies evolves into a very American novel, packed with ideas, though prone to drift. Ultimately, it's a lover's quarrel with this country, and at its best, it has candor and seriousness to burn. Number two was Transcendent Kingdom by Yah Gyasi. Number three, Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. Number four, Deacon King Kong by James McBride. And number five, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. For best nonfiction, the number one choice is Caste, C-A-S-T-E, by Isabel Wilkerson. This brilliant book should be required reading for generations to come, said Jashunda Sanders at the Boston Globe. A significant work of social science, journalism, and history, Isabel Wilkerson's rethinking of racism in America removes the tenuous language of racial animus and replaces it with a sturdier lexicon. Our nation, she writes, perpetuates a caste system in which racial difference is a sorting feature. The award-winning author of The Warmth of Other Suns builds her case by offering comparisons of the laws and mores of the U.S., India, and Nazi Germany, the last of which adopted tactics from the Jim Crow South. Other thinkers have talked about America's racial caste system before, but Wilkerson brings to bear her formidable interviewing and storytelling talents, said Laura Miller in Slate.com. This important book wrenches our established way of thinking about race out of its rut and encourages us to see it anew, creating fresh potential for change. Number two on the nonfiction list is Memorial Drive by Natasha Trethewey. Number three is Hidden Valley Road by Robert Colker. Number four is A Promised Land by Barack Obama. And number five is Just Us by Claudia Rankine. For the music lovers out there, the Critics' Choice for the top album of 2020 was Fiona Apple, Fetch the Bolt Cutters. Fiona Apple's first album in 8 years borders on literature in its ability to convey nuances of the human condition, said Jillian Mapes in Pitchfork.com. Recorded at home and released in the early days of quarantine, Bolt Cutters is the sound of someone freeing themselves from a mental prison built by others but unknowingly reinforced by the self. Apple, a reclusive artist, found release in the elemental rhythms of hand claps, floor stomps, and other makeshift percussion. But the raw energy of Apple's voice is the album's life force, and with it, she's made her truest, wildest record to date. To be sure, much of the material is challenging on first listen, said Chris William in Variety, but the clattering surface parts to reveal earworms matched with emotional catharsis. In the end, Apple Unbolted is a lot like the rest of us, dealing with jealousy and microaggressions, hoping for transcendence, looking for love on all the wrong mortal coils. Number two, Phoebe Bridgers, Punisher. Number three, Taylor Swift, Folklore. Number four, Run the Jewels by RTJ4. Number five, Waxahachie by St. Cloud. The Critics' Choice for the best film of the year is First Cow. If American sentiment had a poet laureate, Kelly Reichardt would hold the crown, said Eric Cohn in IndieWire.com. The latest and best yet of the writer-director's patient frontier dramas is set in 1820s Oregon Territory and tracks an improbable friendship that develops between a traveling cook, John Magaro, and a Chinese immigrant, Orion Lee. When the territory welcomes its first cow, the pair hatch a milk-stealing scheme to launch a baking business. It's a small-stakes heist, but it beautifully expresses a theme that runs through all of Reichardt's works. Even reckless people simply want to find meaning in their small corners of existence. Number two is Nomadland. Number three, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. Number four, Bakura. That's spelled B-A-C-U-R-A-U. Number five is Lover's Rock. Six, Dick Johnson is Dead. Number seven, Collective. Number eight, Time. Number nine, David Byrne's American Utopia. And number 10, Minari, M-I-N-A-R-I. And finally for this piece, we have the Critics' Choice for the Best Television Show of the Year, I May Destroy You. Like Fleabag's 2019 season, Michaela Cole's 12-part limited series was a seamlessly conceived masterwork that is impossible to imagine being written or performed by anyone else, said James Ponowitz in the New York Times. Playing a London author who is coping with the aftermath of a hazily remembered night out that ended in rape, Cole is like a juggler keeping flaming torches, bowling balls, and cream pies in the air, balancing a story that is simultaneously incendiary, weighty, and shockingly funny. Number two, Mrs. America. Number three, Better Call Saul. Number four, The Good Lord Bird. Number five, Normal People. Number six, The Queen's Gambit. Number seven, How To with John Wilson. Number eight, BoJack Horseman. Number nine, P Valley. And number 10, Pen 15. And we'll finish out the year in review issue with on what would have been our health and science page. They set it up in a kind of a two-page spread, and one of them is some of the things they said were good for us and some of the things we were told to avoid, and then finish it with the big scientific breakthroughs of 2020. So we'll pick and choose from those and see what we can get through. Some of the things they said were good for us. Wearing a mask can help reduce the spread of the coronavirus. Several studies have shown that face coverings shield people by blocking the virus-laden droplets and some of the tiny aerosols expelled by infected people. In Missouri, two hairstylists unknowingly worked for a week while infectious with COVID-19. They wore masks in the salon, as did their 139 clients. No customer developed signs of COVID, and all 67 of the clients who volunteered to be tested received negative results. In Kansas, cases in counties that implemented mask mandates fell 6% in 6 weeks. In counties that didn't, they doubled. Not all masks are equally effective. An N95 mask is better than a surgical mask, said former CDC Director Tom Frieden. A surgical mask is better than most cloth masks. A cloth mask is better than nothing. Deep sleep may reduce risk for Alzheimer's. A hallmark of the neurodegenerative disease is high levels of the proteins beta amyloid and tau. Previous research found a link between a lack of deep sleep, when the brain produces slow rhythmic electrical waves, and increased levels of tau. A new study has revealed that the same appears to be true for beta amyloid. The most likely explanation for this finding is that during sleep, the brain activates a mechanism that flushes fluid through the brain, washing away the two proteins. Coffee can substantially shrink your risk of dying early, so long as it's brewed the right way. In a 20-year study, some 500,000 Norwegians logged how much coffee they drank and how it was made. Those who drank filtered coffee had a 15% reduced risk of dying prematurely from any cause. Among unfiltered coffee drinkers, the reduction was 9% for women and only 4% for men. Study author Dag Thell says coffee filters remove substances that increase blood cholesterol, making heart attacks and premature death less likely. Some other things that they said were good for us. Magic mushrooms could ease depression. Turmeric may relieve arthritis. Running a marathon could help reverse the effects of aging. Booze may be beneficial to the brain. In moderation. And some of the things we were told to avoid. Indoor venues accounted for up to 8 in 10 new coronavirus infections in the U.S. last spring. Researchers mapped tracking data from 98 million cell phones in 10 cities, monitoring how many indoor venues phone owners visited over a day and how long they stayed. The scientists then ran a computer model to watch how the disease spread, and it showed the risk of infection was highest in restaurants, followed by gyms, coffee shops, and hotels. It also found that setting an occupancy limit of 20% of maximum capacity at all indoor venues could cut new infections by 80%. Gas stoves pump out pollutants that make indoor air up to 5 times dirtier than the air outside our homes. Researchers reviewed 2 decades worth of studies on gas cooking, which produces nitrogen dioxide and carbon monoxide. Nitrogen dioxide is linked to asthma risk and heart issues and has been shown to exacerbate chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Carbon monoxide can exacerbate cardiovascular illness among people with heart disease, even in low concentrations. Somehow, said study author Brady Seals, we've gotten accustomed to having a combustion device, often unvented, inside of the house. Junk food makes you stupid. Researchers recruited 110 volunteers and told half to keep eating their normal diet, while the other half were put on a Western diet high in saturated fat and added sugar. Predominantly fast food and Belgian waffles. After 7 days, those on the Western diet scored worse on memory tests and were more likely to want to eat unhealthy foods when full. Previous research on animals has shown that junk food can affect the hippocampus, the brain region associated with memory and appetite control. When it's damaged, said co-author Richard Stevenson, food can seem more appealing, even if you're full. Promiscuity is linked to a higher risk of developing cancer, especially among women. In a study involving some 5,700 men and women, average age 64, researchers found that women who had had 10 or more lovers were 91% more likely to have had cancer than those who said they'd had either 1 or 0. Among men, the risk among those with the most partners was 64% higher. It's long been known that some sexually transmitted infections are linked to cancer. But researchers were surprised by the gender divide. Study co-author Lee Smith says it may be because the link between certain STIs and cancers is stronger in women. Other things that were bad for us, third-hand smoke can cause harm even in places where smoking is banned. Hair dye raises the risk of developing breast cancer, particularly among black women. And murder hornets are now in the U.S. Asian giant hornets, which measure up to 2 inches long, are known for invading beehives. And it seems appropriate to finish with the big scientific breakthroughs of 2020, most notably vaccines at warp speed. Only one breakthrough truly mattered this year, the creation of a COVID-19 shot. The previous record for the fastest vaccine development for mumps was 4 years. But on December 8th, 11 months after research began, a 90-year-old British grandmother became the first person in the world to receive Pfizer's new COVID vaccine outside of a clinical study. And it has indeed been quite a year, but we'll have to leave it at that, folks. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm W.G. Alexander & Associates. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they provide their clients the best care by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.